Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I am your host, Martin, and I'm very happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode of the podcast, my guest is Caps, not his real name, who joined me from an undisclosed location in the American Midwest. And we talked about all different kinds of things. The title that I'm giving this episode is 5-MeO-DMT and the Creativity Incubator. And we get to that in the later portion of the interview. But we talk about long distance running, which Caps enjoys doing and is like totally not at all my thing in any way, shape, or form. And how he got into 5-MeO-DMT and working as a facilitator and has created this creativity activating program or methodology, which he uses with 5-MeO-DMT. So we'll be getting to that in just a few minutes, but of course, let's hit some announcements first. Over this past week, I'm very happy to welcome Doug Kimon and Quest Zero as new patrons over at my Patreon page, which is patreon.com/MartinWBall. They signed up at different levels. It's great to have them over there and just love to see that page getting some attention and getting some love and getting some support from listeners and people out there. Also, just a reminder that you can follow my Patreon page now. You do not have to be a paid member. You can just follow it, I guess. I mean, I don't know how it all works, but anyway, you can see what I'm posting over there. And some of the things I only post for my paid members. So you won't get to see that, but you get to see everything else that's over there. And also a reminder that Patreon has added a new shop feature, and I do have PDF copies of many of my books available over there for sale at my Patreon page. They're generally like $10 for the PDF copies of my books. And if you get a PDF copy, then you get all the art that I produce and put into my books. You get that in full color. So that's pretty cool. Also, over this past week, James and Brooke made their monthly contributions in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast via PayPal. Thank you very much, James and Brooke. Both of you have been supporting the podcast for a number of years now. You're the only two people who do that via PayPal, and just want you to know that your support is always appreciated. If you would like to make a contribution via PayPal, you can stop by my personal webpage, martinball.net. Use the PayPal link that's up at the top right of the page. And just speaking of supporters, and especially everybody who's over there at Patreon or who has ever been there at Patreon but had to leave for whatever reason, because of course there's no obligation when you sign up over there and people's situations do change and they need to change their support. I just want to just give a great big shout out and thank you to all of you who do that. Because as you may know, I spend a lot of my time in creative and artistic pursuits. And that means spending many, many hours and days and weeks and months doing quote-unquote non-productive activity that is not financially sustainable. But I spend a lot of time doing this, and it's the supporters over at Patreon who help support me. I mean, this is literally patronage of the arts, that it supports me while I'm engaged in these projects. So like right now, all of my free time over the past over 3 months now has been devoted to this really epic art project that I'm working on, that I'm closing in on being finished with. And, you know, just having that support over at Patreon, that's what helps me feel like, well, I can still pay my bills and I can still support my kids while I am working on these epic art and creativity projects. And so just thank you, everyone over there at Patreon, and anyone who's ever made a contribution via PayPal in support of the podcast and support of my work, just thank you so much. Just, I want you to know it really, truly makes a difference in my life. So big thanks there. Also, just speaking of at my Patreon page, I have a number of 2024 wall calendars of my bird and nature photography that are available over at lulu.com. And I have posted links to a number of those over at my Patreon page. So if you want to check them out, I've got my Golden Eagle calendar, my Bald Eagle calendar, my Owl calendar, my Hummingbird calendar, my Avian Art Forms calendar, which is a combination of my photography and fractal art, which is also a full color art book, which has 100 pieces of art in it, which I released earlier this year. It's available over at Amazon. And so if you want to check out those calendars, the links are available over at my Patreon page. Oh, and of course, there's Birds of Costa Rica. There's Hummingbirds. What else? I forget what else I put up there. Oh, I've got a Crater Lake calendar. I've got sandstone formations of the Oregon coast. Got a Sedona calendar, a Maui calendar. Birds and Wildlife of Florida calendar. You know, I like to take a lot of photos to the places that I go, and this is just one way that I make use of them, is by making some calendars, and mostly I just make them for myself and my family to give as Christmas gifts, because I don't think I ever really sell any of them over there. But anyway, they're available if you want to check them out. Also, just want to put out there that the response from the psychedelic medicine retreat that I participated in the other month has been so positive that the organizers that I worked with on that are looking to organize the next one. That'll be coming up sometime in the spring of 2024, and I will give more details here when all of that is set, but that's something that we're looking to do, so I'm super excited about that. I think it's going to be awesome to participate in that again. So let me see, just going to check my notes here. Anything else that I need to say? No, of course, next week we're going to have the next chapter from the Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT Anthology audiobook. Got more interviews on the way for you, and I've got enough material that's going to get us into the beginning of 2024. So things are just rolling along here at the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast, which, just to remind you, turns 16 years old January 2024. And of course, I'm available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations. You can stop by at nondualentheogenicintegration.com if you want more info about the video calls that I offer. And also, just to remind people that it's not just for people who are looking for integration, but I also work with a number of people who facilitate medicine experiences, generally within the 5-MeO-DMT world. But there are a number of facilitators who do arrange consultations with me to talk about issues that they might be having in their facilitation, feedback about methodology, difficult or challenging experiences that their own clients have had. So I'm always happy to mentor people and to give feedback when desired. And just know that it's not just for those on the receiving end, but also for those on the facilitating end, that I'm, of course, available for that. Okay, that's all that we have in terms of announcements. Let's get into 5-MeO-DMT and the Creativity Incubator with CAPS. Enjoy. All right, well, I am welcoming on to the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast today for his very first podcast interview ever. Dun, dun, dun. CAPS. Which that is not his name, but we're going to call him that. CAPS, from an undisclosed location in the Midwest. How are you today, CAPS?
I'm doing quite well, Martin. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So we've got a whole variety of things that we're going to be talking about today, not least of which is ultra long distance marathon running, because that just sounds like hell to me. So we're going to have to talk about that. But just to share a brief bio that CAPS provided, that he's an avid meditator, an ultra long distance runner. It's still just, I'm not a runner. I never have been. And 5-MeO-DMT facilitator who has spent over 20 years personally exploring psychedelics and is primarily interested in the expansion of human potential through interaction with psychedelic plants, fungi, and materials. So that's a little bit of background there, or a little bit of bio. Let's start with the ultra long distance running. Okay. Because it always baffles me when people, and inspires me as well, though I'm not going to do it myself, but the idea of running ultra long distance, how'd you get into running, and what do you get out of it? Do you get a runner's high out of that? I hope so.
A runner's high is definitely part of the equation for sure. But in a larger kind of meta context, there are many spiritual traditions that utilize similar states of extended endurance as a way to kind of break down the constructs of the psyche. And originally when I started doing this, it wasn't necessarily apparent to me that that was going to be one of the aspects that would come through doing these very long distance runs. It was more of a sense of curiosity that inspired me. And I will say that very early on in my life, I had some tremendously torturous, very long LSD as well as 2CE experiences. And when I got into running extremely long distances, some of the more intense aspects that you would encroach on psychologically, let's say, you know, 8, 12, or 16 hours into running 100 miles through the mountains, were very similar to the levels of kind of suffering that I had experienced in prior LSD and 2CE experiences. So on some level, I felt like early psychedelic experiences gave me some psychological footing that helped me out in my running career. And then I also think that later in life, you know, having those extremely long distance runs mentally prepared me for going back into working with high dose psychedelics personally. But, you know, it's really hard to say what the overall motivation is. Like I said, in the beginning, it was curiosity. I read Born to Run and I realized that, like, oh, hey, there's these guys down in the Copper Canyon and they're running 50 to 100 miles and they're not hurting themselves. I'd always heard that, you know, after some set amount of time, it was really dangerous and detrimental to your body to continue to run. And that was kind of a, I would agree with that sentiment if you're running form is kind of clunky, but I believe that there is a way to run very far distances fairly fast and without injury. And you have stories throughout history. You have people who traveled the Inca Trail in South America who would routinely run 100 miles at a stretch. You have the Tibetan, I believe they're called the Longampo runners, who were mythologized as running almost like twice that distance in one day. And these were considered living Buddhas. And when they ran by, like, you weren't even allowed to look at them and they would never like make eye contact with you. And then in the Japanese culture, you have the marathon monks of Mount Hiei who take this tremendous vow to complete these different physical tasks, some of which are like running 60 miles a day for 300 days straight. It's like a big thing that they do, and they commit to this so wholeheartedly that if they fail to complete their task, they have to kill themselves. So you have like kind of a interesting history that really demonstrates that it is possible to run and traverse these vast distances on foot without causing harm to your body and even gaining some positive psychological affect through doing so, of like, I don't want to say conquering mind over matter, but at least like befriending the aspects of your psyche that emerge when your self-defense mechanisms are down. Because when you're running for 1 or 2 or 300 miles, your body stops being able to prop up a really solid defense mechanism. And so there's a lot of times where during very long runs, like, you know, old memories are surfacing and I'll be like crying and, you know, just like pouring out stagnant emotional material from my psyche that, you know, I'd been withholding for whatever reason. So, yeah, I realized that was a whole lot and a mouthful, but it's a very curious thing, even to me, when I think about it, I still don't quite understand the full aspect of like how or why.
It's really fascinating. It just makes me think of something that I either heard this on the radio or it was in a TV show, or I don't know where it was, but it was really recently. And it was about somebody was talking about running. And what he was saying is about one of the reasons that he enjoys running, and particularly running long distances, is that he said you reach this point where the whole goal is to just put the next foot down, and then put the next foot down, and then put the next foot down. And he was kind of describing this as just this purity of mind during that time period, because, you know, you're not worrying about what's going to happen when the glaciers melt and who's getting elected to office or how am I going to pay my bills next week. It's just like 1 foot, 1 foot, 1 foot, 1 foot. And that kind of gave him sort of a Satori like experience of just being able to focus on that minimalistic event of just keeping putting 1 foot down and then pushing past the pain and the fatigue of all of that. And so I can see how people might gain a certain sense of spiritual value from engaging in that kind of high intensity, long endurance practice. So for you, what's the longest run you've ever done?
So first of all, I would agree completely that there is a very beautiful presence that you can aspire to or attain, like in the midst of the run, where, you know, the universe shrinks down to only what's in the immediate contents of consciousness, like only your surroundings and only that next step. And it's a very deep and beautiful state of flow. And as a meditator too, you can even bring in elements of meditation to this practice of looking for the self or the center of the self. You know, while you're in the process of doing this, you can take in your whole visual field as one unified field and recognize that everything that's happening has the intrinsic qualities that all passing phenomenon have of the ephemerality and non-self, etc. So like there's all of these opportunities too where you're just alone with your mind and your thoughts, and you get these wonderful opportunities to observe yourself. And there have even been experiences of dissociation in the midst of really long runs where suddenly the perspective shifts, and it's as if you're seeing yourself from, you know, some distance behind you and above you, and you're almost playing your own body like a video game, which is a very unique experience, but very akin to a psychedelic experience.
Yeah. My dad used to be a big runner. He just turned 80 and, you know, he's got all kinds of back issues, so he's not running anymore. But he used to tell me about how he would go running and that there were a lot of times where he would arrive somewhere and suddenly realize he had no recollection of how he got there because he was just, you know, in this zone.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that for my dad, who is like one of the most ultimately non-spiritual people ever, that it was kind of a meditation for him. And I think it's been very hard for him to let go of that because he is a thinker who wants to think about things all the time. You know, he's a chemist and he's always thinking about chemistry. And I think that he actually enjoyed like, I don't know how I got here. And I don't remember the experience at all. That just is just this one thing that happened, you know?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. And of course there's the, what people call highway hypnosis too. When you're like driving along the highway and then you show up at a place and you're like, oh wait, I don't remember three quarters of me getting here. And there's different schools of thought about, that being, you know, this valuable flow state. There's some meditation teachers that I think would say that that was evidence of being like lost in thought completely, right? Which is like sort of the antithesis of the goal, is to not be kind of driven automatically without conscious awareness of the contents of consciousness. But, you know, it can go either way. And either way that you look at it, it is like a healthful experience, because my dad experiences the same things at times. And like for him, running is this big aspect of having a positive mental health. So it's a powerful way to, you know, he describes to me like, oh, whenever I'm upset or whenever I'm really mad at something, I know I can always like go take a run and everything just calms down and my nervous system just calms down and everything kind of settles and sorts itself out.
Yeah.
So there is that aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Dad, I love you, but I would have to probably say that I think he's gotten grumpier in the time that he's not been able to run.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, but I love you, Dad. I love you, Dad. If you're open to it, I'd be interested in returning to this topic that you briefly mentioned in starting this conversation about running, that you mentioned some long LSD and 2CE journeys that you described as suffering. And my curiosity is piqued because, as you know, I do integration calls with people, and I do get a lot of people who not only have been blown away by their entheogenic experience and they just need somebody to talk to about it, but there's also been plenty of people who have been through deep states of suffering. And sometimes it's mental anguish, sometimes it's emotional anguish, sometimes it is deep, deep physical pain and suffering that people go through. Mm-hmm. And I really think that this is an under-discussed topic in the psychedelic world, especially as we move more and more towards therapy and psychedelic ceremony, and we tout all the benefits of psychedelics and how wonderful and beautiful and loving and kind and healing it can be. But it can also be really, really dark and can also, you know, engender quite a bit of suffering in people. So I'm just curious if there's anything that you'd like to share personally at that level about what you've experienced and, you know, just what any thoughts you might have on that, if you're comfortable. But if not, we can go to another topic.
I think that there is something very intrinsic to the psychedelic experience about experiencing deep suffering, because there is so much suffering in the world. It's completely bizarre the varieties of the types of suffering that you can experience as well. And for some reason, I still believe that they're healthful, like kind of holistic experiences, because you come out of it with a greater sense of compassion, I would say, more empathy for other people's experiences who are outside of your own, et cetera. I could describe a couple specific experiences. Of course, I've had some tremendously physically painful 2CE experiences, which is quite a chore because you're in it for quite a long haul. It's about a 14-hour experience when you get up into the 25-milligram range, at least for me personally. And that was just kind of like this pins and needles, like there's no way you can sit comfortably in your body, and you just kind of like want to curl up into a fetal position type of thing. And the visual aspects of that are just, you know, sensing yourself being burnt up, like as if you're trapped inside of a house that's on fire, with the corresponding sensations. And just that sense of no way out and no escape, and there's just this hopelessness that is completely consuming. Mm-hmm. I feel like in literature, at least, you know, I have a background with a lot of breath work, and a lot of the early framework that I put around psychedelics was largely influenced by the work of Stanislav Grof. And he talks about these perinatal matrices as related to the birth process showing up in psychedelic experiences. And there is one particular matrix that he relates to, you know, this aspect of being born where you're starting to be crushed as a little baby that's about to come out, and yet the cervix and the vaginal canal are not fully open, so there's like no place to go. So you're getting this like kind of intense crushing experience. And he relates that a lot to the aspects of psychedelics that have that quality of complete and utter hopelessness. And hopefully you get to the other side of that and you like eventually like make your way out to the light of day and are reborn into a new thing, but you don't necessarily always complete a process in a psychedelic journey either. So yeah, 2CE was, you know, kind of like that type of experience. And then on LSD, there's just a remarkable amount of ways in with which it kind of decimates your sense of self. You know, I'm not sure I love the terminology of ego death, but it probably is like the most appropriate terminology in the sense that I'm speaking of, where at times you experience being in a scene where you're violating someone, like just brutally beating someone into the ground, and then your mm-hmm. perspective flips and you become the person that's being beaten to the ground, and it just will like flip back and forth and even speed up faster and faster and faster until that there's some sort of a knowingness that like these two individuals are playing a part of this larger whole, this the dynamic between them that transcends the two of them. And at times we all play these different roles in our lives too, of like the victim or the perpetrator, and we both play into creating that dynamic. So it's almost like a yin yang sort of thing, but the sensation of being in that experience is not pleasant whatsoever. I mean, you have moral qualms when you're the perpetrator, and when you're the victim, you're just in pain and feeling violation. So yeah, that I've had that experience flip-flopping the perspective between victim and perpetrator in LSD, in a mescaline journey, as well as in a holotropic breathwork experience. So that was definitely a theme that had repeated itself, and there was definitely some lesson to be gleaned from that about the dynamics of relationships and suffering and the false dichotomy or the duality between victim and perpetrator too, as being two sides of the same coin that could not exist without one another, almost in like an Alan Watts type of sense of transcending that duality.
Yeah. So it sounds like in those kinds of manifestations of suffering within the psychedelic experience, you're able to find some really some quite deeper wisdom within that, as you say, of transcending the duality and recognizing that both these aspects exist within all of us simultaneously, and that we play these different roles and we take on these different identities, and that the dynamics that we share with others and with ourselves actually creates these situations in some way. But when it comes to like with the 2CE experience of feeling pins and needles and trapped in a burning building and that sensation of fire, because you know this is something that shows up which is kind of different from context, right, where you get like a mental and emotional context of events happening, whereas sounds more like just a direct physical suffering. Is there anything that you feel is valuable in that, other than when it finally breaks and you get out, it's like, oh, thank God that's over. I have more sympathy for burn victims now, but it seems a little bit harder to me to kind of, you know, milk some wisdom out of something like that, other than saying like, wow, that's sort of a fucked up trip that just really sucked.
And I sort of trust in the process personally, that, you know, what is being uncovered through my consciousness, through the interaction with these materials, is helping to shape my psyche into a more mature, like more individuated person. And with that particular experience, I honestly couldn't tell you like much of the larger context, except if I were to relate it to the Stan Grofian framework, like it was probably just some latent energy from the birth process that was unexpressed that finally like had this opportunity to move through me. And I will say that while I don't create a whole lot of meaning out of the experience, I can say that afterwards I did feel like tremendously lighter.
Yeah.
So it is as if, you know, something that I was carrying is no longer present after the experience, even if I can't consciously verbalize or put it into a framework that, you know, creates more meaning for my life, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that that's a great way to look at it, because I think that there can be a tendency to overdetermine meaning within psychedelic experiences for people. If they want to say, oh, well, that was definitely my birth trauma or something like that. But, you know, we're getting into areas where we don't really know. There's an energy, yeah. There's a sensation, there's a yeah. reaction and a perception to it. And there's a feeling that arises afterwards. But I like what you said about sort of just trusting the process, that, you know, there is value, I think, in people experiencing suffering. And especially, even though often in the psychedelic experience, when people are suffering, they describe it as, I feel like I'm trapped there forever and mm-hmm. it's never going to end. But then it yeah. eventually does. And so it's not a permanent condition. But I do think that that opens up the door to new levels of empathy for people who either are experiencing a temporary state of suffering or perhaps a more chronic condition of yeah. suffering. And really gives us that sense of, wow, well, I suffered, but I got out of it. Thank God. That wasn't permanent. But I can really understand that feeling, because I think you mentioned the words of just hopelessness, that sense of
yeah.
there is no hope. And, you know, that's part of the human experience, that hope is part of it, but also that sense of hopelessness. And there's a lot of people in the world who are trapped in conditions that produce a lot of hopelessness. And that if we haven't suffered ourselves, then we can kind of blithely say, just think positive thoughts.
It's like, right, no,
it,
yeah.
it fucking sucks. I can't just think positive thoughts. You know,
yeah.
that sometimes suffering needs to be endured. You can't just think your way out of it. But sometimes you can. And actually, so this was another question that I wanted to ask you. If you've had suffering experiences where the breakthrough in the suffering has come about with a realization. So what prompts this question is, I was doing a consultation yesterday with a gentleman who was describing a 6.5 gram mushroom experience that he had. He said that for like 5 hours, it was just existential dread and hell. And he just said it was just the most awful experience that he ever had. And mm-hmm. just was just fighting and just terrible, terrible, terrible. But then he finally sat down, and suddenly the thought arose in his mind that I'm doing this to myself. And in that yeah. instant, everything shifted. And this is where it does get very interesting, from where suffering can just on a dime, it can flip to a very different experience. But not all forms of suffering are open to that kind of just mental reorganization.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have some thoughts on that?
I've definitely experienced that. And I've experienced that when I resist suffering, as in creating this story that, oh, this is something that I don't want in this moment, yeah. that tends to exacerbate it. Like that tends to yeah. kind of prop it up and maintain its status. It's usually, you know, this sense of, okay, if this is my reality right now, that's okay too. It's kind of this acceptance of mm-hmm. if this is what's happening, this is what's happening. And it's not trying to argue against what is. And it's kind of interesting because you can't really use that as a strategy, because you can't really fake it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like you can't say like, oh, I know what'll stop this is if I accept it and then accept it. It's a really more of a like, okay, if this is what is, then this is what is. And then also I will say that, you know, part of learning to meditate is you in certain types of meditation, like Vipassana, you're paying attention to a specific sensation, or, you know, in a more concentration type of meditation, like you can be sitting for like a long period of time and there's sensations that arise in your experience, and you have this moment of inflection where you can choose to really get granular with that particular sensation and observe it neutrally, or you can interpret it as pain. And the interpretation itself is what causes suffering more than the sensation, because, you know, a sensation is a sensation. It's only at the level of the interpretation of it where it becomes pain versus something else, because many people experience the same sensation and have remarkably different interpretations of it, even to the extent where you have things like BDSM being quite popular and people like really enjoying what other people would consider to be intense pain.
Right.
And furthermore, you could also imagine that the context of the sensations plays a large role in the interpretation too, because if you're, let's just say, for instance, working out really hard at the gym, lifting weights, or you're on some type of machine, you have all of these sensations inside of your experience that outside of the context of the gym, if you experience them, you would think something was terribly wrong, right? And it would be incredibly painful. But because you're at the gym and you know that, you know, what you're doing is ultimately like making micro tears in your muscle, and this is part of a process that you want to engage in, you don't interpret those sensations as pain or otherwise. So, you know, interpretation is a large part of the story as well.
Yeah. And, you know, that just makes me think of the experience that I'm sure many people listening have had, where you have, you know, you've actually damaged your body in some way. You've hurt yourself, but you haven't had the sensation of that happening. And then like somebody points out like, hey, like, why are you bleeding from your head? And then all of a sudden you notice the sensation,
right,
and yeah, you interpret it in pain, and yes, you also interpret it as like, oh my God, what's happened? What's wrong? Right. And all the story that comes with that. But I think it's even fascinating how the sensation itself can be absent from the event that actually caused the damage in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, we get these mystery wounds.
Right. You know? Totally. Yeah.
And then, you know, and then you see your hand like, oh my God, I cut my finger, and now all of a sudden it stings like mad.
Right. Yeah.
But when you didn't know, it didn't hurt. I mean, it's just, it's so curious how that works. So there's so many different kinds of pain and sensation, and how it gets registered within the mind, and how then it gets categorized. And I love the distinctions of the examples that you just gave there. So thank you for joining in that conversation a bit about suffering and perception of that. I think it's an important topic.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know anybody who has like taken ayahuasca and, you know, had very intense purging for a long period of time that called that like a pleasant process either. So
yeah,
it's like, you know, kind of part of it. And when you were talking about the pain too, like, I also thought about the experience, which I'm sure you've had and many people have had, where a small kid like falls and scrapes his knee and then kind of gets up and looks to the parent. And there's this pause before they either start crying or go back and run around playing. And it's almost like they're looking at their parents or the adult, right, for the interpretation of the experience. And if the adult is the small kid, will respond with breaking out in tears and throwing this big fit. Whereas,
okay, so, you know, sorry, we just had a internet verbal there. So you were just saying when the child looks at the adult, and then we got a little transmission interference. So if you could just repeat what you were saying.
Oh yeah, just the conversation about the interpretation of sensations as pain or otherwise. It also made me think about the situation where a small child, like a 3 or 4 year old, falls over and scrapes their knee. And there's this moment where they like look up at the adult that's next to them, as if to get an interpretation of whether they should be upset or not from the adult. And depending on the adult's response, the child will kind of mirror whatever that is. So if the adult is very, oh my God, what happened to you? Let me take care of that for you. You know, the kid will be like, oh my God, I'm hurt, and start, you know, crying and tearing up. And then, you know, other parents that are, you know, a little less touchy-feel in that regard might be like, oh, you're fine, go on. And the little kid will run off and play. You know, I've seen both of those things happen in the same situation.
Yeah, yeah. That pretty much exactly that happened to me when I was a kid. I was out riding my bike and I crashed on the gravel and really skinned my knee, like pretty severely, and had like little bits of gravel like embedded in there. And I remember when that happened that I was kind of fascinated because I was looking at my knee and I was just thinking about, wow, it doesn't even hurt. Like, but like all the flesh is torn off and like, wow, that's really kind of weird.
Right.
And then I went home and I was actually more concerned that my mom was going to be mad that I like crashed my bike and, you know, scraped up my bike. But then she saw my knee and she's like, oh my God. And then I just burst out crying at that point. But before then I had no emotional reaction and didn't even really perceive it as pain until that feedback came from my mom. So it's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about pain forever because everybody has pain. I mean, it's something very relatable, pain and suffering.
I would like to just add one note on the aspect of suffering too, because many people have the experience in mushrooms of, you know, losing their mind completely and feeling like, oh, they're never going to be able to function again. Like they've lost all of their aptitude for intelligence or cognitive function and everything has changed. And this is how they're going to be now. They're going to walk around in the streets, like counting molecules and kicking trash and sleeping under bridges because they're just a hopeless shell of their former selves. And I actually had someone who was a 90-year-old therapist who had never done psychedelics and who had this experience on a fairly low dose of 2.5 grams of mushrooms, and they came out of it and they just said to me, like, I had no idea the mind could be such a prison, you know. Like, and he's like, I've been working with people for so many years and I've never understood that what they're experiencing, you know, in these states of schizophrenia or otherwise, could be so tremendously awful, like such an inescapable prison, like worse than any prison that you could put a physical body in, like to have a broken mind in that type of context. And he was just crying for all of those people who he couldn't, you know, empathize with, despite his best efforts of wanting to be like a good therapist for all of those years. And he was like, I wish I would have experienced this like much earlier in my career, because it would have changed the way he had interacted with people.
Right. And that goes back to that idea of through experiencing our own suffering, our own challenges or difficulties, breaking of the mind, whatever it may be, that it really opens the door to genuine empathy, not just professional empathy. Right. Oh, I hear you're suffering here. Let me help you. But like, really, I can identify with that. I think that is one of, you know, when it comes to motivating human beings, that if a human being can say, I can identify with that, that's where the juice really is. And that's why we work so hard when we want to other someone or a group of people, that we work so hard to dehumanize them, to put them in a completely different category, that we can say, I am so different from that, that I could never identify with that. But I think you and I both know we're all human. We should be able to identify with pretty most aspects of human behavior and experience because we're all humans. We all have the same basic setup of wetware and hardware and the potential for both beautiful and negative experience. And so that broadening of identification, I think, is what can be deeply transformative through these suffering experiences.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's go ahead and let's turn the conversation now to 5-MeO-DMT, because we do want to eventually talk about your facilitation of this molecule. But let's start with your own personal entry point into 5-MeO-DMT and how that came into your life and in what way and what it meant to you and then we can move on to more facilitation questions and philosophy and theory.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had been primarily working with high dose of mushrooms in my personal experience. And I had a spiritual friend who was this older gentleman, a yogi. He's, I think, 72 years old now. And he began to get back into psychedelics around the age of 67 or so. And we had connected about that and practicing yoga and a few other things. And, you know, I had read about 5-MeO-DMT as early as 2004 on Arrowhead. But back then, the reports were very like, oh, this is not particularly interesting. Like, you kind of, there's not a lot of visuals. You just kind of like get shot off and then you come back and you don't know what happened. And so at that time, it was just like not on the radar whatsoever. Whereas like DMT was much more on the radar and much more well known and established, and people having these fantastic experiences. And my friend, who I'm not going to name him or anything, but he had gone to see a 5 facilitator, and when he came back, you know, his eyes were very like bright and shiny, and he was like, you know, Caps, I'm just breathing so deeply. I felt like I've been breathing half lungs my whole life, and this experience, I'm having this incredible somatic experience with my breath, and it keeps unfolding, and there's just, you know, waves of it that I'm still processing, and it's helping my yoga, it's helping my meditation, and it's helping my breathing, all these other things. And because I had done more modern research, I was wary of it. I had previously met some people who went a little off of the deep end with it. So I had met somebody who had such a transcendent experience that in the period of time where I interacted with him, he seemed like he was largely rejecting his humanity. And it wasn't something that was bringing him closer to other people in his life. It was kind of isolating him. And since his experience, his, you know, daughters had stopped talking to him and all of this other stuff, because he was just, you know, a little too far off in the etheric with the angels instead of dealing with the stuff that he had to deal with in his life. So I was like really cautious, knowing that my main kind of guideline for working with psychedelics is this giving me like a greater sense of belongingness in the world instead of isolating me from other people and stuff like that. So are psychedelics like kind of creating an ego that feels superior or separate from other people or somehow higher or better, or are they opening me up to a greater sense of compassion, empathy, belongingness, community, and all of these other kind of qualities? So I kind of use that as guideposts. So I was definitely wary of it. However, he started to train with the Conclave right away, because he got some 5, and once he had had maybe 20 or 30 breakthroughs, realized that like, oh, I want to find other people who are really involved with this molecule and learn from them. So after about like 20 or 30 breakthroughs, he started working with somebody who was like involved with the Conclave, and they started sharing information and resources on serving and everything else. And I ended up being one of his first people that he ever served 5 to. And that first experience was very remarkable, because it fell so well in line with the experiences that I was having in meditation of trying to recognize the various aspects of the mind in real time. And, you know, I had this like pure transcendent experience of, you know, the explosion into everything all at the same time, and, you know, just complete loss of identification or subject-object dichotomy, and just the vastness of the experience that, you know, you come back and you're like, oh, my word that I thought of immediately was like, okay, this is the absolute, like the capital A,
yeah,
absolute, you know? Yeah. But even laying there and watching, like in a kind of observer stance, I would see the various aspects of, you know, what I would call my personality coming back online one by one. And I would see my thoughts come back in, and then I would lay there and I would just be the observer, and my thoughts would get more and more interesting, kind of like tempting me to get back into, you know, the container of identification, you know? So it was this tremendously beautiful experience, and it precipitated a lot of additional emotional release afterwards too, where, you know, the next day I saw like a flower and just started crying because it was so beautiful, and those types of things that continue to unfold in the space afterwards. And because I wanted to explore more on my own, I got some 5-MeO myself and started experimenting. And I will say that, you know, the experience was really, you know, they do kind of evolve over time, and there are even different levels to the breakthrough. I mean, there's just the space of pure whiteness, and then there's almost like this, you know, I'm not sure what the furthest out level is, but there's like the complete utter blackness of void that you can experience. And then there's this, the immersion and dissolution in the white light. And then there's also this kind of ocean of chaos that I experience, where it feels like you're in an ocean of energy and everything is just arising and consuming itself all at the same time. And it's just this vast sea of energy that creates and destroys and creates and destroys at different levels, at like fractal type levels, from like the smallest amount and then outward, larger and larger. So it was all really fascinating and, you know, unique to 5 compared to other psychedelics. It did start getting a lot of visual experiences later in the original explorations of the material. But, you know, it's so much about the somatic nature of the energy in your body and the way that it's just like inviting this lightning bolt to move through your energetic being. And just felt like it was running up against places where there was stuck energy and just kind of allowing those to process and move out. And it's just so wholly remarkable that it's hard not to be curious and very interested in it. And, you know, it also raises all these questions of the nature of reality. Like, what does it even mean that, you know, I can be here talking to you, Martin, and, you know, have this experience of being in a room and feeling the sensation of air in my body and these thoughts arising in my mind. And then, you know, within 10 seconds from now, like all of that can be eviscerated and I can be in this, you know, this state of non-self, and apparently that's all there is and all there ever was and all there ever will be, like,
right,
you know, like all of these things. It's just and then the fact that it's endogenous in our body. So needless to say, I did a lot of personal exploration, and then I began to work with some of my friends who are interested in the experience. And I had read, because I am a kind of avid reader, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to do anything stupid. So I wanted to learn from the mistakes of other people before using this with other people. So I had read your book, and originally when, and I'm speaking of the Entheogenic Liberation book. And so originally I was like, oh yeah, this seems like a good way to work with people, of kind of get in there, get in the non-dual space, like surrender yourself to it and allow yourself to be a vessel for the other person to surrender, because I was able to surrender myself pretty easily. And even at lower doses, I could really allow that energy to move that, you know, would flow through me in such a way that it was similar to what you described with the symmetrical motions. And, mm-hmm. you know, there would just be all of this stuff going on. And I considered that, but in working with people, what really ended up happening in the way that I work with people is I do take 5-MeO with them while they're in the breakthrough space. But what naturally emerged through my process with people was just really like a lot of sounding at different points of the experience. So there's times where if, you know, I'm not conscious of what's going on, but just my body makes a tremendous amount of noise during the experience. And that noise somehow modulates their experience. And a lot of times I will purge, which only happens when I take 5 with other people. So there's something there too. But I ended up not really being physically touching people during the experience. Occasionally, like I'll use a little feather, especially if I don't feel comfortable taking it with them. So like I have to feel really comfortable. Sometimes I'm just a provider for people. Because it doesn't feel like the energy is right to like interact with them in a shared type of energetic space. Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening is I will sit at their feet, symmetrical with them, and they'll go into the experience. And if the energy gets really big, either I will sound, and I'm hesitant to make the types of sounds because they're very like primal and animalistic, or I will purge, and then they will just like calm back down and kind of lay back down into relaxing into the space, which people describe later as sensing, like sometimes they sense that like they themselves have howled or made noise when they haven't. Right. And like sometimes they achieve that on their own and I don't have to do anything. So, you know, I really don't do a whole lot in most of the experiences, but somehow it emerged this type of sounding practice. And I have since heard of this happening to one other person. So it's kind of curious to me that the interactions with 5 kind of bring out different aspects of different people and the way that they work with people.
I'm really curious about these soundings, as you call them, because that was a huge part of my own facilitation, was just that freedom of allowing the body to be a vehicle for things that might need to physically happen, as you mentioned, but also for the expression of sound and just the diversity of different sounds that would come out, and how the person having their session, even if they couldn't tell you what sounds were being made during the session, they would say like, well, these sounds were happening and it was propelling my experience and it was so important, and that this one sound came at just the right time, and then this other sound. So when these boundaries between self and other are collapsed, that it does make it open for you as a facilitator, if you're open to it, to allow just these noises in a whole variety of ways to come out. And I think one of the key features that you've touched on there is you called them animalistic, and that it's often the kinds of sounds that come out are not the sounds that we would normally make in any kind of social normal interaction or conversation. And they can be identified with different kinds of animals, but that's not what's happening, right? Because sometimes people take sort of a shamanic view, like, oh, well, you were growling, so were you a tiger? It's like, no. That's not what's happening, but there's a vibration there that needs to be expressed. But this is where your own comfort working in the transcendent state is what makes you available to make these sounds, because otherwise the ego says like, well, I can't make a sound like that. Like, I mean, because that's just too weird,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's just, this is the sound that needs to be made. And even in making those sounds, and go ahead, you can disagree with me if you have a different perspective. But for me, it was always, I don't know why this sound needs to be made right now.
Yeah.
Like, I've got no particular attachment to the why. There's no explanation other than this is just the sound that needs to be made right now, so I'm going to do it. And that, and even in asking later, why did you make that sound at that time? The answer is just, well, because that was the sound.
Right.
So, yeah. So it seems you're in agreement with that.
Yeah. And my own process with making sounds was also unlocked during a 5 session, but it was one of these things that was what I would consider to be like an extended psychedelic experience, where something happened in a session where something was unlocked, and after the session I just kept making these noises, like they just kept happening. Mm. And for, it was at least 2 months where you know, sometimes I would have to run into the bathroom and just like let my body sound and move, because it just wanted to come out so badly. And then sometimes it would be like while I was driving in the car, and like I had to make like really a lot of time and space to allow myself to process whatever it was. And it's one of these things that I just have no interpretation for either. And I didn't really ever feel like I needed to either, but that was something that was happening for at least 2 months before it really calmed down. And, you know, sometimes as I was like laying down to go to sleep at night, it would reemerge, and yeah. It just felt like this energy wanted to take over, and I could feel the making the sounds too, like the vibration in different areas of my body, like all the way from really the base of my spine, like up to the top of my head, like this, the different tonalities as they would cycle through would be like hitting on different areas of my body. Which for some reason, maybe it was because I'd heard of people experiencing things like that before. I didn't get overly concerned with it, which many people would probably find odd, but you know, I guess it went back to the acceptance piece of like, I was like, okay, I guess this is my life now. I guess every time I'm alone, I'm going to be howling.
This is just what's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, that was really interesting. And I was happy that I had the, time and space at the time to not have that interfere too much with my life.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that it does seem like things like that tend to show up if you do have time and space to process it. You know, it's yeah. almost like there's a convenience mode built into 5-MeO to some degree, where if you're going to be going through reactivations in many instances, or if you have to do more of this somatic processing or vocalizing or toning or gurgling or howling, yeah. whatever it may be, it tends to show up when people do have time. And sometimes people create resistance to that by saying, well, no, I want to be doing other things right now mm-hmm. rather than doing this.
Yeah.
But if they look at it more neutrally, they usually can come to a perspective of, well, actually, I can take 30 minutes and go in the bathroom and go howl for a bit. You know, I don't need to watch this TV show right now or whatever it may be. So, you know, it usually doesn't show up when you're in a business meeting.
Right.
I'm curious if when these sort of the intimations are coming on that, okay, this energy needs to be processed and expressed now. I'm curious, you sound like you've been very open to it and very allowing and just kind of going with it. But were there ever moments where you tried to say, "Whoa, no, not now." And then what was your experience in having that? So one of the reasons I'm asking you this is because, so when I was going through my process, that for me was, it was not only sounding, but there was a lot of movement that was involved.
Yeah, no, there's movement involved too. Yeah.
So one night, the whole movement sound thing had like pushed me onto my back patio that kind of looked out over a green space, and then there were some neighbors nearby, but it was at night. And so I'm out there and I'm doing my symmetrical movements and I'm like throat singing and doing all this stuff. And then a neighbor came out and got in their car and their headlights shone on me. And I suddenly became very self-conscious. Like I'm like the freak out here in his yard. So I stopped what I was doing and I was immediately overcome with just overwhelming nausea. So then I said, fuck it, you know, just do it.
Yeah.
So then I went right back into doing it. Nausea immediately dissipated. So I'm just curious if you've had any kind of experiences like that.
Yeah. There was times definitely where I was feeling like very large upwellings of energy. And I had that self-consciousness in order to refrain from expressing it. And I felt like almost like my stomach would cramp up and, you know, because my hands would want to move and my whole body would get very tense. And it was like really, it was really difficult and it was quite painful to do that because it just, I don't know how else to describe it, but it was just like something was welling up that needed to emerge and not allowing that was just like building this pressure internally. I would find a way to, like I said, like go in a bathroom and, you know, I'd put my shirt over my face to try and, dampen the noise and stuff like that. So, but yeah, my body would be moving too. And it would be this very, you know, at times very ecstatic experience too, like where the energy was, you know, immensely enjoyable to be moving through my body.
Yeah. So it sounds like what you're describing here is what I like to call the energetic reconditioning process, which is extends well beyond the actual experience, the direct experience of 5-MeO, and can extend for, you know, a period of time. And if I'm following your narrative correctly, it sounds like you went through a period where this was happening, but it sounds like now this is not so much happening, but you are able to just easily access this now.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Sessions.
And this was happening well before I ever served anyone else. I went through a very like intense period of self-exploration before I had the desire to serve anyone else. And even now, it's not like a tremendously big desire for me. Like I work with people that I'm really kind of inspired to work with, and also people who are primarily concerned with, I would say, like creative activation or spiritual exploration. I don't work with anybody who is wanting to heal trauma because I just don't have the what I would consider to be like the relevant experience to be able to hold those people through recovering from trauma. I will say that the people that I work with, they do experience very powerful healing, but it's kind of ancillary to our intention of really understanding like what this experience that we're all dwelling in, like what this mystery is, or deepening that mystery by like having this experience, which I do believe is like a fundamental human right that human beings should be able to access all levels of their consciousness and be able to explore the space of their own body and mind with these compounds. So I have people that I refer, people who want to work with trauma with, I refer them out to them just because that was, you know, the medical model is wonderful for the level of acceptance that it's bringing to our culture for psychedelics. Like I never would have imagined in, you know, 100 years that my grandmother would be asking me about psychedelics, but they knew Michael Pollan from reading The Omnivore's Dilemma and all of these other things and all the New York Times stories. Right. And so it's really like done wonders to change the mainstream narrative around psychedelics. However, my own personal interest has always been more of, you know, what happens, like, you know, like, what do psychedelics do for healthy people? Like, how do they allow us to mature and experience rites of passage? How do they deepen our communion with living and life itself? And, how do they even create more awe of the mystery of what even this is, which we still, you know, I showed up here. I didn't create myself, supposedly flying around on a tremendous rock at 150,000 miles an hour in this vastness of space, which is too impossibly large to comprehend with our current ability to conceive, you know. And meanwhile, we're made of these atoms that are made of elements that have been around since the beginning of the universe. And even inside of these atoms, there are more fields than they are material. So, you know, they say like, oh, even inside of an atom, it's 99.99% empty space. Yeah. Because it's really just these forces interacting with one another. It's not like this material basis. So all of that is like, you know, very inspirational to me. And remembering that this thing is fundamentally mysterious and that we can't ever possibly even hope to comprehend the whole gestalt of what the universe is or like what we are, is a fundamentally driving force in my life and like a source of great inspiration and beauty and creativity and everything else. So
yeah, and that's so far beyond just the, well, I, you know, I was traumatized as a child and, you know, I'm looking to use these medicines to help relieve that, which is great. It's great that psychedelics can help people with issues like that, or, you know, veterans, people who've been in combat situations. But you're absolutely right that they also are this entry point into the experience of the mystery. And yeah. I really love that you're here referring to just the basic nature of reality that we live in, this absolutely fascinating place. That's what gets me excited as well. Like I'm not very interested when people want to start getting into metaphysics and alternate realms and all the rest of that. So like this reality that we're living in, this is fascinating enough. I mean, the fact that we live right. in this infinitely vast universe with billions and trillions of galaxies, and we are made out of billions and trillions of these little packets of energy that are just vibrating waves of energy, mostly empty space. I mean, that's fucking mystery enough. Like we don't need to, you don't need to add anything extra in there. Yeah. Like this is already, and that you and I can sit here and have a conversation and talk about the experience and perception of this thing that is happening. That's amazing.
Right.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the medical model, I want to say it's valid. I just think it's equally valid for us as human beings to explore these things for our own personal reasons that don't have to do with healing trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. So you kind of mentioned about the people that you choose to work with and referencing other people out for more trauma-related issues. And I'm just kind of curious because I've spoken to a few other people who are in the Midwest, and again, it's an undisclosed location, so we're not going to say precisely where, but, as you know, I live in a very different place. I'm in Ashland, Oregon. So this is where we're at in Ashland, Oregon at this point. So like 2 weeks ago, so my 10-year-old son, he's in fifth grade, and the parents in his class, once a month, we do like a parents' night out, right?
Yeah.
And so all the parents go out and we have dinner and we sit around and chat with each other. And like here, one of the other parents told me, oh yeah, well, I saw something that you had written online about, you know, psychedelic guides and you know, how to work with patients and stuff like that. And so I'm really trying to apply that to my own practice. And then all these other parents are jumping in and they all just want to talk about psychedelic therapy and psychedelic experience. And then they said, oh, but we know you've worked with 5-MeO. Can you tell us more about that? And so that's the environment I live in here in Ashland. Yeah. And we've got a number of places now downtown where you can go for legal psilocybin therapy. So it's a totally different environment, I would imagine, from living in the Midwest. So that's what brings me to the question of how do you guys find each other in the Midwest? How do you make these connections and still live in this culture where there's there's probably less awareness in your area, though, as you mentioned, things are changing because now anybody in the world can go on Netflix and they can, you know, watch How to Change Your Mind. Right.
Right.
So it's a lot more accessibility, but still there are cultural differences. So how do you guys find each other?
So I've lived in both worlds. I've lived in Southern California for a large part of my life. And I know that there's coffee shops there and there's ayahuasca circles at the bulletin board at the coffee shops. And, you know, so that's a completely, it's a different thing. And I live my life out here fairly open. I feel like most people that I connect with will connect about something. And if there's a good rapport between us and they'll ask me like what types of things I'm interested in, I have no problem sharing about my psychedelic experiences. And so we have psychedelic societies out here, and I've been to MAPS and met people at the MAPS conference, and you know, you meet people at music festivals and everywhere else. But it is a little bit more word of mouth. And I personally like that. Like, I like working with people that I know and I have a relationship outside of like a stranger showing up at my session space and like immediately like going into a five session. That's just what's felt more appropriate for me. Not that there's anything wrong with any other way that anybody does things, you know what I mean?
It's just your preference.
Yes, totally. So I've given talks at psychedelic societies in the region, and people connect in different ways, and every once in a while sometimes you meet somebody on a street and you make eye contact and you can tell, like, you know, you've seen something, you know, like like there's a certain depth to their character that you understand that they've been to, you know, great depths in their experience through whatever material. So it's not that bad, and things are changing. And we have, there's a lot of bills to attempt to legalize psychedelics for use with veterans and stuff in different states across the Midwest. So change is happening quite rapidly. Yeah, so that's what I'll say. And I will say too, early on, I loved, you know, the uniqueness of Five is the breakthrough space in itself. And early on, I was like, why would anyone take less than a breakthrough? Because, you know, that's what this is special about this material. Like, if you wanted to do less, why wouldn't you eat some mushrooms or take some mescaline or, you know, do whatever? But I had a session with a facilitator out in Los Angeles. And after he took me through the breakthrough experience, which was done quite wonderfully, and it was one of my it was the first time I tried a lamp of light, which works pretty well, even though it's like hard to reload to do multiple rounds.
Is that one of the argon gas?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But afterwards, he took me through this experience of working with a mandala and a stroboscope, and we hovered in a mid-dose space of about 5 to 7 milligrams. For a good hour. And while I am, you know, sitting across from this mandala and the light is pulsating on it at different frequencies, which correspond to different brain states, et cetera. And, you know, I'm on this like musical journey and literally like flying through the center of this mandala as if I'm like flying through deep space. And I was just flooded with so many ideas. Like afterwards, I just had to get a pen and paper, and I just wrote down like, okay, like this is what I want to do with my life, and this is what I want to create, and all of these artistic projects and creative ideas. I was just so inspired, like coming out of that space. And so largely I do work with people like that now, and I call it like a creative inspiration or creative activation. And it's this whole thing that is not particular to 5-MeO. I feel like you could do it with other things, but 5-MeO makes it so easy to stay at this boundary where you're like connected to a spirit, but you're in your body and you still have this cognition, and there's a lot of mental clarity too, like all at the same time at that like 5 to 7 milligram level. And this is after people have done breakthroughs. So they've kind of had like the, you know, the whole shebang typically, but we'll kind of create this environment where I use some fans and I use incense and I use big speakers and I use a giant mandala and I use a stroboscope and I put them in this chair and I have them like lean back, and then I give them the kind of medium dose pen to hover at that level. And this has been like a wholly remarkable experience for almost everyone who's experienced it. And it's one of those things that is more, you know, you're not transcending the ego in any way, but you get so much beautiful ideas about what you would really like to do with your life from doing it, that I was really like happy to have been introduced and to be able to share this particular style of working with five with people, because it was not something that I would have imagined. And so it's really interesting to me that there are these other ways of working with five emerging too.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It kind of sounds like sort of an imagination cocoon that you're putting people into with the, you know, with the sound and the stroboscope and the mandala. And I think it also just, it's important to always remind ourselves that, you know, there's nothing wrong with the ego. And there's nothing wrong with the ego having ideas and having an ego that is inspired.
Is
feeling creative. Because, you know, in non-duality, no one ever created anything ever because there's no motivation. Right.
Yeah. There's nothing to do. There's nowhere to go. Everything's perfect.
There's no subject object. But as embodied individuals, engaging the creative function, like for me, that is the most satisfying part of my life, is engaging in creativity and making shit, and taking pleasure in that is just so enjoyable. And so, you know, I've never had the experience of not being inspired creatively. I mean, it's just that's not me. I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. But just thinking about how, for anyone who feels stuck or doesn't feel like they're creative, if they could be given a modality such as this to just feel themselves being supercharged with creativity and inspiration, it's like, what a beautiful thing. What an incredible gift to be able to give to someone.
Yeah.
So how long have you been, how long have you been working in this particular modality now?
Really only for the past year. I've been doing that as well as the breakthrough sessions. So when people first come in, we almost always do breakthrough sessions, even though I use a pen. So I'll let them go in a little slowly. Like we don't kind of take, whatever, like 15 milligrams right off the bat. We'll kind of take two or three and then two or three more, and we'll try to get right up to the precipice and go over the edge into the breakthrough space without, you know, so they're not like blacking out entirely and just coming back and be like, what the heck happened to me? You know what I mean? So they like, you know, have a hope of coming back with recognizing the fullness of the experience. But yeah, really only in the past year. And, you know, the inspiration for it, like I have to give credit to my friend who introduced me to that process, even though what I do now is sort of a direct result of the inspiration that I received from that process, because I came back and I set up this space in my house and I would take five in there and I would say like, okay, now I need to add this to the space, and now I need to put lights here, and now I need more candles here. And, you know, the sensation of air moving across your body when you're on 5-MeO is ecstatic too. So there's like a little bit of almost airflow in the room to kind of activate more of a somatic element. And there's just, it's just all these like little things that I tweaked when I would like sit in the space and take five, and then get more ideas of how I wanted the space to evolve. And now it's kind of the ideas are a little beyond my capabilities at this point in time, but I'm like slowly aspiring to create them.
Well, that's awesome. And I look forward to hearing how it develops and evolves over time. And just as you're sharing this, where my mind is going is like, man, I hope one of his clients comes to me for an integration call at some point, because I want to hear their side of what they said about all of this, because this sounds really interesting.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So yeah, there's cool processes, and you know, I have friends working too, and they love working in the low dose space and like very, very, very slowly going through each level of the experience. Which, you know, people have really good feedback from too, in terms of unwinding stuff from the nervous system.
Yeah. Well, there's so many different ways to work with these materials and so many different ways to engage. And it's just exciting to hear that you're finding these kind of creative, immersive modalities and working across these different levels. And yeah, so I think that that's probably going to wrap it up for our conversation now. I'm going to go attend to my family, but thank you so much for your time today, Caps. Yeah. And thanks you for sharing all of this and everything from the running to the suffering to 5-MeO breakthroughs to the energetic processes that get worked out somatically afterwards and into this creativity incubator that you're describing here. But just thank you so much for your time and for all this sharing. Is there anything else that you wanted to be sure and mention that I didn't ask you about? Or?
No, I mean, I feel like there's so much we could talk about. We could probably have spent the entire time on any one of those topics. But I really enjoyed talking to you, and I appreciate your work and the inspiration that it brought me early in working with Five. And I also, like, really quick, wanted to just share my gratitude for all of the people who, you know, whose shoulders that I stand on at this point in time, like, because, you know, I'm not an isolated individual, and everything that I've experienced in my life has been benefited from the life's work of so many other people. And so I just wanted to kind of pay my respects to people like Stan Groff and Sasha and Ann Shulgin, Earth and Fire Arrowhead, my breathwork mentor, Michael Stone, you, Martin Ball, Sam Harris, my inspiration from Christopher Bache, Roger Rabbit, Leonard Picard, Alan Watts, Albert Hoffman, Aldous Huxley, Alex and Allison Gray, Douglas Harding, and Kylia Taylor. So I just, you know, I feel so grateful and also spiritually indebted to these people who were able to do this work, particularly when it was so much, the landscape and the environment was so much more dangerous and unaccepting. So I just want to acknowledge all those people, and all of the ones that I did not say, because there are many, many, many more. So thank you.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. Thank you for adding that in. I'm glad that you were able to express that gratitude. That's awesome. Well, thanks again. It's been a pleasure getting to speak with you again. We've had our private conversations, but it's been delightful to record this one and give it out to the public. So thank you for stepping up.
Yeah, I hope there's some value in it, and have a nice night.
All right. You too.
Bye.